สัพพะโลวาโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะ Join in please นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะ Homage to the Buddha, the blessed, noble and fully self-awakened one. Chanting tends to be a monkish thing. It's, I suppose, the leftover of a oral tradition, but also, like any singing together, creates a sense of community. You only go to the football crowd, you know. That's one good reason for chanting. I just wanted to say a few words about... posterity. I have to get a bigger clip for me. Is that it? When Buddhism comes into a culture, it says, you know, it's put in a way that it sort of melds its way, you know, it sort of insinuates almost its way into a culture. But that's really looking at it from the wrong angle. It's more that when a culture begins to understand Buddhism, begins to receive Buddhist teaching, it always receives it through its own cultural biases. And there are four cultural biases that Buddhism is being received in the West. The first one is science, yes? The second one is psychotherapy. The third one is romanticism. And the fourth is, if you're brought up in one of the God-fearing religions, through Christianity or Islam or Judaism. So these, in a way, slightly distort the teachings of the Buddha. So just as a sort of food for thought, you might say. Science in itself, of course, is perfectly wonderful. but remember that although science tells us how things happen, they don't really say why. So therefore, we have what's known as scientism, which is just another form of materialism, where everything is material, it must come out of matter, therefore consciousness is simply something that is an emergent property from subatomic particles, genes, and so on and so forth. And there's nothing beyond that. And there's a general feeling that if you can't measure it, it doesn't show up in an MRI scan or see with an electron microscope, it simply doesn't exist. And it's just the mind making things up. So that sort of distortion really undermines what's coming to us from the actual scriptures. And I'll come to that in a minute. The second one is psychotherapy. And the insights of people like Freud, Jung, Maslow, and all the rest of them are obviously of tremendous help to us, and they have their place. But psychotherapy tends to medicalize our situation and tends to put us into a situation where the blame, as it were, for our suffering is slightly shifted onto somebody else, and that we have issues. And when we have issues, it's the other that normally has to change. It's not quite the way the Buddha saw things. The third one is romanticism. Romanticism, as you know, is a reaction to the rationality of the Industrial Revolution and the satanic mills and all that. And the whole idea was to get back to nature. Wordsworth, especially I think the German romantics, I need to read them again, But you find ideas of being at one with nature, losing yourself in nature, interconnectedness, and the idea of psychism, that everything is consciousness. All these ideas are within our culture, and it's easy to interpret some of the Buddhist teachings in that way, especially when they move into the Mahayana. And the final one, of course, is a Christian viewpoint. When the Christians first came across Buddhism, they simply thought that he was teaching annihilation, simply that. Nirvana was a blowout, that was it. Once you reach Nirvana, you disappeared. And so there's this view of Buddhism as not really being a religion because it doesn't have a god. So you get all these, and yet, funnily enough, even so, a lot of Christians would use the techniques of the Buddha, Vipassana, within their own practice. So all these are slight distortions of the Buddha's teaching. And this came across to me when I was teaching at Gaia House, and somebody came to me and said, I've been reading and listening to all these teachers. But when I actually read the discourses themselves, I was a bit shocked because it's all about rebirth. See? Now, when you read the scriptures, there are three things that come across which are just hit you, as it were, very, straight in between the eyes. The first is the Buddha teaches ethics. It's an ethical view. Secondly, rebirth goes right back to his own personal experience of enlightenment. It's embedded within the whole tradition. And thirdly, he's trying to get us to a point where we can experience something which is utterly transcendent of the physical mental world, of the psychophysical organism. Now, when it comes to ethics, his whole teaching is not about trying to find out what caused our present suffering. Our present suffering, mental suffering, is a product of the past, and therefore the past is irrelevant. We have to deal with the product. So if I'm depressed, searching for something that caused it in the past would be, in the Buddha's eyes, a bit of a waste of time. Our problem is to be with the depression and to find out how we're relating to it. If I start getting depressed about being depressed, I'm going to make things worse. That's a wrong relationship, right? If we define ethics as relationship, parts of which are a morality, but it's basically about how we relate to what we're experiencing. So he's concerned with this relationship that we have, which is translated in our language as desire. Unfortunately, this desire isn't quite right. Because you can obviously have good desires. When he was fully liberated, his first desire was to teach, was to share it with others. So it's a wrong desire arising from some wrong, deep wrong relationship. Okay? And so the whole process is an ethical one, it's a moral one, about getting our relationship to, first of all, ourselves and others, moving away from self-centeredness, selfishness, greed, lust, and all the rest of it, towards some form of generosity. Moving away from all forms of hatred, aversion, etc., and moving towards love. Moving away from all forms of cruelty and moving towards compassion. That's the movement that he talks about, and it's an ethical movement. Okay? But you're also dealing, of course, with your own mental state. And what we discover in our practice is by just being with the heart in its present condition, whether it's anxiety, anger, greed, lust, and the rest of it, just to stay with it, to see our relationship to it, how we want to indulge those things that we enjoy, we want to develop them, even though we know they're unwholesome, and we don't want to go anywhere near stuff that causes us any form of discomfort within ourselves, constantly pushing it away, hiding it from ourselves. Once we can see that, and we allow that to arise and pass away, So you can't, if you suppress that, you create even more problems for yourself. So it's being aware both of the original arising problem, depression, anxiety, whatever it is, and seeing our relationship to it, and just to allow this turbulence within the heart-mind to express itself. And we find that that is actually the cure. You don't have to do anything except be patient, right? You have to learn patience and to just be, and just wait until that process comes to an end. And it keeps coming, and it keeps coming. And one of the disappointing things about our practice is that we find there's mountains of this stuff inside us. And that whereas we thought we might take just a couple of years to become happy, it's obviously going to take a bit longer. So coming to terms with the fact this is a long-term project, we develop this attitude of patience, equanimity towards ourselves and of course towards others. So that process is one of working with things from an ethical point of view, by which I mean a relationship which is either doing us harm or doing us good. Right? That's what I mean by ethics as such. This long relationship goes very deep. It goes right back to this relationship of awareness with itself. So when you're in meditation and you're aware of being the observer, a self-awareness, this is not the self-awareness of pride or the self-awareness of embarrassment or anything like that. It's just that feeling that there's somebody who feels, somebody who knows, etc. Yeah? That sense of the observer within ourselves, okay? Now, that's a relationship that awareness has with itself as it feels its presence within the mind and heart. Right? Now, because of, I always use the Greek myth of Narcissus, which is normally one of self-love and whatnot, but it works perfectly as a spiritual problem. When Narcissus looks in the pool, he falls in love with his image, and he goes to embrace it. As he embraces it, he falls into the water and drowns. Now, in mythology, water is always creation. So here we have an image of ourselves within this psychophysical organism. And as we move into the psychophysical organism, we find pleasure, we find joys, etc. And we identify with those. That's the falling into the waters. Now that process of identification is the process whereby we create suffering for ourselves. And this identification is what the Buddha is pointing to when he says, this is not me, not mine. So he wants, as it were, for us to come out from the water and sit back on that bank. So when we have a physical self, such as when you catch your finger in the door, just for that one moment, you are the pain in your finger. Right? That's what we mean by identity. You lose yourself, a sense of self-awareness, and you become what you experience. When you are emotionally involved and you get really angry at something, and you just lose yourself, sense of self-awareness, you go berserk, you become an emotional self. When you're in yourself thinking about something, imagining something, you become a mental self. And when you're in meditation and you can constantly feel yourself being the observer, the feeler, you become this inner self, this one removed. So you can see the process is one of always stepping back from your experience to find this perch within yourself to observe. Okay? And it's in that process, as it were, moving backwards from what we're experiencing, that we come to experience what's transcendent. Now, the Buddha is very coy about pointing to that. Having expressed everything as not self, he's confused a lot of people. The Jains said, well, we and the Brahmins, we believe in a soul. The materialists do not believe in a soul, but the Buddhists can't make their minds up. And this whole teaching about self was just, there's lovely bits in the scriptures of the confusion of people over it. So he points to it, for instance, in a phrase such as, That is, that which is not born does not die, is not compounded, is not conditioned. If this were not so, there would not be an escape from that which is born and dies, conditioned or compounded. Now the word he uses in the Pali is asti. There's another word for is in Pali, hoti. So when you say something like, this is a mat, you would use hoti. But when you talk about exist, you use asti. So when he's asked, does the Tathagata, that's how he would refer to himself, exist after he dies, or does he not exist? Does he both exist and not exist? And, this is a killer, does he neither exist nor not exist? You get your head around that one. So this was the quadrilemma of the time. Of course he's silent because the question is always coming from an idea of a self. So he doesn't, he's caught in between, he's caught in between trying to express what is inexpressible without creating some sort of concept about it. Concepts are incredibly dangerous. In later Buddhism, as you know, there's this concept of emptiness. So sunya is also within the Theravada scriptures, and it just means empty. And what it means is insubstantial, empty of a self, empty of anything which is substantial. It's the same meaning as anatta, not self. Mahayana philosophy extended that to everything, you see. So they ended up by saying everything is shunyata, everything is empty. But then it became a conceptual problem, so they had to say that emptiness itself was empty. The emptiness of emptiness. So eventually, when you try to express the inexpressible, you just end up in a paradox or just a contradiction sometimes. So, he's then drawn by certain questions, and he can't shift out of certain questions. So one question says to him, where is it that the world comes to an end? Now, the world for people in those times wasn't the objective world that we've created since our own particular enlightenment, thinking that when we see a tree, that's the way the tree is. The world was understood to be the way you experience the world, your little bubble of consciousness. And he says, no, he said, it's wrongly put. The question should be, where does the world, that is your psychophysical organism, where does it not find a footing? Now, and then he says, there is a consciousness which is not touched by any of the senses, which includes in Buddhism the mind, the heart. And it is without boundary. What in the phenomenal world doesn't have a boundary? It is without boundary and in all directions full of light. Just this is the end of suffering. So he's pointing to something which is transcendent. And his most, what is considered to be the most clear statement was his use of the word ayatana. And ayatana in his language is a sphere of experience. So we're made up of six ayatanas. The first sphere is that which is your visual sphere. And then there's your hearing sphere, the five senses, and your mental heart sphere. These spheres cannot cross over each other. So you can't hear through your eyes, even though you might try very hard. So these are distinct spheres of experience. Okay? Then he says there is a sphere where there is nothing to be sensed. There's no moon, there's no sun, there's no coming, there's no going, there's no standing still, there's no time. And he goes on through a whole load of stuff and then says, just this is the end of suffering. So he's pointing to something in us which does not belong to the psychophysical organism. And it is that experience which changes our whole relationship to the world we live in. Right? Now, that relationship some of you might know the ox herding pictures of Zen. Having experienced this, even for some people, even for a moment, their return into the psychophysical organism as a human being brings that transcendence into the moment, and it's called immanence. So the Zen people were very much into more immanence because, like us, they found the whole idea of transcendence very difficult. So in the ox herding pictures, you have this, first of all, there are mountains and rivers, and there are no mountains and rivers, and then there are mountains and rivers again. And those are the monk, normally it's the monk in the pictures, and you see him looking at that river. Then there's a circle, which is the moment of transcendence. But then he returns back, he sees the world as it is, and then he comes back to help the world in the tenth picture. So that's the process that the Buddha wants us to go through. And it includes both a purification of the heart, right, and a growth of wisdom. Now, if you look at dependent origination, which is the psychology of the Buddha, it starts off with a position of not knowing. Sometimes it's translated as ignorance and stuff. This not knowing produces a wrong relationship to the world, as I am this body, I am this person, and therefore there's a seeking of happiness in the world. Once you seek happiness in the world, you then form a relationship of acquisitiveness, right? You want to gather things. The more you gather things, the more you feel safe. The more money you have in the bank, the more friends you have, etc., makes you feel more worthy, more happy, etc. But unfortunately, other people want what you have in one way or the other, and therefore you have to fight off the enemy, and you find yourself getting very angry with people, and the aversion opens up. When the other is just a wee bit bigger than ourselves, we have to run for it, and that's the fear and anxiety. So this wrong relationship to the world of thinking I am this body, this mind, and I have to find happiness in this form produces three wrong relationships. It's an ethical problem of acquisitiveness, aversion, and fear. And from then we act, and then comes the second level of all our problems, guilt, remorse, shame, and all the rest of it. So slowly but surely we build up this inner world of ourselves, within this bubble, this horror story. Okay? And of course there are delightful times, and I can't deny that, but generally speaking, it's a sort of general horror story. That's why there are so many counsellors and psychotherapists. So now, having created this, we get really worried, and we think, well, maybe I ought to do a bit of meditation. So you end up meditating. The meditation is trying to make us see things differently through those three vantage points of how we create suffering, the role of desire, this impermanence, and this not-self, like this body's not me, this body's not mine, etc. And in so doing, at the heart level, something else is going on. Because just as this ignorance wasn't purposeful, it's not as though we are guilty of knowing something. We just didn't know. When you're born, what do you know? You just end up thinking, well, I must be this. And the society tells you that's what you are. From a heart level, we start with innocence. We never, ever meant to do any harm. If we had meant to do some harm at the beginning, how could we ever be purified? However, because of wrong thinking, wrong relationships, we create this horror story, and then we come back on it, and so the purification of the heart takes us to immaculacy, takes us to purity. So from a lack of wisdom, from a state of confusion, a state of delusion, we're moving towards wisdom, and from a state of innocence, we're moving through suffering to purity. That's the trajectory of our practice. But that's always at the level of the psychophysical organism. Something, the Buddha is saying, is beyond that. Right? Is beyond that. And he's pointing us to that position. Now, this whole process is difficult to imagine that you could do it in one lifetime. And so, the teaching of being reborn, right, which is not the same as perhaps you might think of reincarnation, it's never the same person being reborn. Even from the point that you were born to the point you now, your whole personality, just like your body, is changing at its own little rate. So we, whatever we were at the age of three, I hope we're not now. We moved on from being a three-year-old. So that process is a continual process of rebirthing. It's happening now. It's not as though it only happens at death. The body is constantly rebirthing, right? It's not the same body. It's not the same body now as it was 7 years ago. It's not the same mind. We have different thoughts. It's not the same emotions. They're all similar, but they're not the same. So the process of rebirthing is happening now. What happens at death is the falling away of this outer shell of our physicality, and the mental body arises. That's the teaching of the Buddha. There are three entities, for want of a better word. Our physical entity, our mental entity, and that in us which is transcendent. That's what you get from the scriptures. Now, you might say to yourself, well, it's a load of rubbish. There is only the body, and that's quite obvious to me. Well, all I would appeal to you is to just leave a little crack of maybe. You know, why do we have to come to hard conclusions? What's the purpose of that? Why can't we just say, well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't, and just carry on doing the practice? As soon as you come to a conclusion, that's it. Your investigation really has stopped. All you're going to do is satisfy your own ideas as to what the Buddha's teaching and as to what you want from the Buddha's teaching. But if you just leave it open that there may be rebirth and there may be in us something which is transcendent, then maybe there's the possibility of experiencing that. There's no reason to shut those gates. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Not vigorously, please. Thank you very much. So it's just really for us to recognize that we're always coming from a position of bias. Right? Always. It's very difficult to know our own biases. Right? And that, and you know, that's a word that people tend to be using now. Prejudice is too strong. It's just a bias. We have these cultural biases, and we're often just not aware of it at all. Yeah? It's making those things aware of that. Now, if you actually care to read the scriptures, they can be extremely boring because they're very repetitious. It is the old oral tradition. Sometimes they're a bit difficult to grasp. But there are good commentaries on it by certain writers. And slowly I think you'll begin to see the world from the Buddhist point of view. That's our purpose. And then we have to decide whether we want to actually practice according to that view and see what are the consequences of it. So the whole process of liberation is the process of exploration. Yeah. That's it, I'm afraid. I've done mine. So let me have a go at some of these. The first one is, what is spiritual healing? So I think that's... the whole spiritual healing is undermining, first of all, these delusions that we have, right? We call them delusions because we start off by not knowing that we're actually deluded. The whole definition of delusion is that you don't know you're deluded. Otherwise you wouldn't be. So it's a case of recognizing that something in us isn't seeing properly. It's not relating properly. How do we know we're not relating? Because when we're suffering, anytime you're suffering, something's gone wrong. Right? There's a wrong relationship somewhere. What is intention? Why is it necessary? Ah, yes. Intention is a wish, a desire, is the arising of the arising within our mind of something that we want. It remains potential. So this is the important thing to grasp, really, that an intention remains potential. Nothing's actually happened. Okay. Then there's a point where it's empowered. Now at that point, the will turns this potential into an actual. And as soon as you commit an actual, whether it's a thought, a word, or a deed, there's going to be consequences. You can't stop the consequence of an action. Because that action is into a matrix of outer relationships, so you don't know what the hell people are going to do with it, And it falls into a matrix of your inner relationships. You don't actually know what the effect of it will be on you. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the monastic code, we have different levels of wrongdoing. The first one is a very simple one, a dukkata. It's just something you shouldn't do. But if it's a serious offence, it's called a garu. And if it's really, really bad, you get kicked out, see? Now, one of the things you get kicked out for is stealing. Yeah, stealing something. So let's say that I see your mobile, which is the new... and I have a desire for it, okay? And you've left it there. So now I might see that desire in me to take that particular mobile. Okay? I see it, that smartphone, but I pass by, so nothing's happened. Okay, I've noted the desire. I've noted it as unwholesome. I won't indulge it. I pass by. Nothing's happened. Okay, just an old desire arising for a decent mobile. Okay. However, when I come back, I see it again. Okay, and as I see it, my hand moves towards it. Oh my God! But I pull it back. It's just in time. Right? Now there's been a little empowerment there. There's been a little empowerment of that will. And just that movement creates in the monastic order a small offence. Okay? Which in the old days they don't do so much. You would have to confess when you all get together before you recite the Vinaya, the rule of the monk. And so anyway, I won't overcome that temptation, okay? And then I walk past again, and this time I'm overcome by the desire. I reach out for it and I touch it. I call back. Oh, you see, I'm slowly empowering that desire. The desire is getting the better of me. But I didn't take it. Therefore, this is a serious offense, a garbo, but it's not actually stealing. Unfortunately, on the fourth passage, as I pass by, I really am taken by it. I actually grasp it and move it a nanocentimeter, realize what I've done, and I drop it. Sorry, I feel. For that one nanosecond, I committed the act of theft, and I lose my role. That's it. And I don't even get the phone. Lots of them. So that gives you some idea of the process of desire, how unwittingly we begin to empower it, and how we create a situation which has consequences. Now, it might be on the positive side that out of the goodness of your heart you do something and somebody really hates you for it. There was a case that I always bring up is a group of people in Totnes who decided to send clothes to a place in Africa. So they collected all these clothes and sent them to the poor people in Africa. Well, of course, it upset the tailor trade, which had an economic effect throughout. And eventually, they realized they were doing more harm than good, and they pulled off their clothes. So you don't know what the effect of an act will be. Inwardly, you might do something which is seemingly on the surface just a very simple thing. You might see one of these people on the streets and actually talk to them and make that connection with them. See there's an awareness of suffering, and then there's compassion. Right? So we're all aware of people crossing the Mediterranean, drowning, etc., etc. It's only when we see that little child crumpled up on the beach that the connection is made and we want to do something. So there's a little distinction there. So just by turning to this person on the street and having a chat with them, suddenly you find yourself moved enough to actually do something, which was not your intention when you just thought, well, I'm just going to do a chat. So an act of intention is only potential. Doesn't mean you've done anything. But as soon as it moves, either as a mental stream of thought, or as a speech, or something that you do,
you enact it, and there will be consequences. Our purpose is to make sure that all our intentions are wholesome, that's all. And to be vigilant when something is unwholesome and just to hold the balls, you see. Because even if we do something which is good, but is received badly outside, it still means that we, inside ourselves, have to do something good. I mean, I'm always amazed, because of course we live in a society where we just take our freedoms for granted. But it always amazes me how people will undergo torture and imprisonment and the loss of freedom to gain rights that we just take for granted. And I often say to myself, well, if I was in that situation, would I have the courage? Would I have the courage to do that? Well, I'm not so sure, is it? So it's recognizing things like that. When you see these intentions come, make sure that your power is good, and you wait for the power of an intention, of a desire, to exhaust itself. Every time you do that, you undermine the divine power. Okay. Is there any questions about that? Intention, why is necessary? What is a nimitta, and how do we enter? A nimitta is just a very strong mental image created by the mind. If you're watching the breath, for instance, it can become conceptualized in the mind as a light source. The purpose of doing concentration meditation, one of them is to begin to develop these very beautiful states of mind in that ecstasy. In terms of the process of liberation from delusion, you don't really have much to play unless you're an adept at that, and these objects, these mental objects, nimitta, and the mental state itself becomes something that you investigate. Otherwise, they become just another form of indulgence. It's one of the last things to go just before you become liberated, your attachment to beautiful states of mind. So if it comes up through your practice of vipassana, then it's just something to observe. And what you want to know is it permanent or not? Or is that because it seems very steady, it seems to be a real sort of thing, to have some sort of steadiness to it, and you want to know whether it's right or possible. So, the quality of impermanence, as well as your relationship to that mental state. So these absorptions are at a lower level when it comes to us when we watch a good TV game. They disappear, don't they? And you wake up and say, is that identity with something in us which is pleasant, which is beautiful. The advantage of these inner ecstasies is, of course, that you don't need anything. That's why you just get a piece of old cloth, sit under a tree, walk around with a bowl, and then go back and be happy. So that's the beauty of being able to create your own inner ecstasy. Yeah? Could you talk a bit about the stages of insight? The stages of insight, the vipassana jnanas as they're known, are to be experienced, but unfortunately you can't make them happen. So in a sense it's a waste of time knowing them, because if it's time for them to arise, they will arise quite naturally. And if it's not time, well, they just won't come. And that's it. And the vipassana jnanas are basically seeing more deeply into phenomena these three characteristics, namely the process of impermanence. And this takes you into a place where you're beginning to realize that everything comes to an end. And that takes you more deeply into the whole suffering of letting go. And then finally there's a deeper insight, and eventually you come out the other side with deep enough insight that changes your view. Now, one of the things that changes is your view of self, which is not the same as a sense of self. Okay? So even though your view of self has changed, has been ruptured, there's still a strong feeling of me. Okay? Now, as an example, take somebody who, in the same place, would have smoked and thought nothing of it because, well, promoting good for you, because the advertising tells you that, and it calms you, and, well, you know, what's wrong with that? And then slowly the science comes through, and you begin to realise that actually it may cause you cancer, heart disease, all sorts of problems, and your view of smoking changes. Now you see it's dangerous. Does that mean you stop smoking? Oh, it's only when you have a heart attack when you stop smoking. So that's the distinction between a view of self and a sense of self. The sense of self stays all the way to the bitter end. Even though as we begin to realize through our practice that it is actually a delusive relationship with the psychophysical organ. One of the problems with these stages is that they have become popularized. People read about them. They read about the actual experience. The Mahasi himself wrote about it, but they tended not to be popularized. But I think that the writer called himself an Arahant. Daniel Ingram, yes, he made them very popular. And what happens is, of course, people have ideas, concepts of what these Vipassana Jnanas are, and therefore they start chasing them. And this happened, actually, when I was practicing with my teacher, because at the end of a retreat, he would ask us, he'd go through the Vipassana Jnanas and ask us to determine where we were. And luckily, I never got caught up in that because I was so neurotic anyway. I was just concerned with my emotional, mental state. But it really became something that people really went for. And I remember it was a sad case, really. This friend, he was highly intelligent. Actually, been to Cambridge. And he really... really wanted, he had that sort of, I've got to get it. And he came to a point where he began to give up. And he said to me one day, he said, I'm giving up. So he went. And I didn't realize at the time what that meant. I met him again on another retreat, and I thought that was just a passing phase. But again, he sort of had that thing that, well, it's not for me, it's not working, I can't get it. But I remember about 10 years on, when I ordained, in the first year he came to see me, I hadn't seen him in years. And that year alone he spent £10,000 on crack. So you have to be slightly careful, because one thing which is really dangerous spiritually is to give up. You can stop. You can say, well, I've had enough. I'm going to have sex, drugs, and rock and roll for a while. But you never say, I'm going to stop. Because that leads you into despair. Basically, what happened. Yeah, he's talking about that. Dangerous times. So, abandon all expectation of achieving the stages of insight. Right? But live in hope. Why desire instead of suffering? I don't understand. Why desire? Why desire? Why desire instead of suffering? Desire is. Desire arises out of a state of suffering, or else you wouldn't be desiring. And is itself a state of suffering. It arises out of unsatisfaction. And is itself an unsatisfactory state. That's why you seek to feed it. Okay? I think I've come to the end. I think I've done it. Unless there are any questions. Confusions. Criticisms. Oh, I would like to know what criticism. No. Editorial.
Then there is the potential that you were talking that you're already kind of in the mind state to achieve it, but then the next step, which would be the reaching out for the form, but in a positive way, when it's a personal intention of changing something about your own needs, it's a bit
no, that's
more
cool.
difficult to achieve. You know what I mean? So how do you implement that intention?
Well, first of all, you start with making these resolutions. Now, a resolution lasts for as long as you say it. So you have to keep making the resolution. And then you have to be vigilant. As soon as that opportunity comes, you do it. You see? And the more you do it, the more confidence you have in doing that, in changing yourself. And just in growing. It's just a case of doing it. It's the action that counts. Very good. Can I leave you with a little blessing? See, it's a monkey's thing, you see. This blessing is, may you enjoy good fortune. May all the powers, the gods and goddesses and the force be with you. And may you enjoy the blessings of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Bhavatu sabba mangalam rakkhantu sabba devata sabba buddhanu bhavena sabba dhammanu bhavena sabba sanghanu bhavena sada sotti bhavante. I hope we all meet again. Satipanya.